Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat and host of this program. Offbeat is a proud supporter of WHIV 102.3 FM. I encourage you to visit offbeat.com to read our new digital edition for October, featuring a cover story about Dana Kurtz, a singer-songwriter whose music is a blend of jazz, folk, pop, and blues. You may also know her as the lead singer in the band Lulu and the Broadsides. You'll also find feature stories about Nathan and the Zydeco Cha-Chas, John Fogerty, Johnny Vodakovich, and Chapel Hart. Check out our album reviews, live music listings, original photos and videos, plus podcasts of past episodes of Beat Cafe with your subscription at offbeat.com or follow us on social media at Offbeat Magazine. I am pleased to announce that the Best of the Beat Awards will return on November 10th to the New Orleans Jazz Museum. This year's Lifetime Achievement Award will honor blues man Little Freddie King. Check out the lineup of music acts and ticket information by also visiting offbeat.com. My first guest on this episode is Samantha Fish, a singer, songwriter, and guitarist, best known as a blues performer, but whose live shows and albums also include a mix of rock, country, funk, bluegrass, and ballads. We'll hear one of her most popular songs, Bulletproof, where she plays one of her trademark cigar box guitars. The second half of the program features the father-son duo of Orlando and John Prince Gilbert, two jazz saxophonists who have teamed up for a new album. We'll hear their first single titled New Orleans Party. And with that, let's get the party started. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Samantha Fish. She's a blues rock singer and guitarist. She will be appearing at the Bluesberry Festival in Covington, Louisiana on October 8th. And in 2018, she was voted both Best Guitarist and Artist of the Year at Offbeat's Best of the Beats Awards Ceremony. And of course, that's just one of many, many awards she has won as a musician. So welcome to the show, Samantha. Thrilled to have you here today.
And thank you for having me.
So Samantha, I thought I'd start out by reading a great quote the New York Times wrote about you. It said, "For the last decade, Samantha Fish has been one of the most promising young blues performers working. A punchy singer and a rowdy guitarist, Kill or Be Kind, one of your albums, is her first album for the roots music powerhouse Rounder, and it demonstrates the range of her palette, which takes in Southern R&B, rockabilly, and much more." Great words to describe your talent, of course. And, you know, you don't just solely classify yourself as a blues singer. You do cover a wide range of genres. So perhaps we could just start by talking about that.
Absolutely. My musical upbringing kind of is like everybody's now. I mean, I grew up in the age of the internet. So you kind of had this access, you know, to a lot of things. And I think music, as we, you know, the younger generations, as they're going to start, you know, becoming musicians, probably going to have this same, you know, I call it a problem. Some people call it, like, you know, an advantage. Like, I don't know if it's a problem or an advantage, because, you know, then you get into this thing where now we the music is all over, you know, several different genres. So it's kind of hard to classify, I think, for people who are, you know, purists and want to put things into certain genre categories. But, you know, I definitely feel like the blues has always been, you know, when I started playing guitar, that's what I gravitated towards. So I feel like my voicing, my expression, everything is so heavily rooted in that genre. And my heroes, you know, the people that I've, you know, kind of based my technique off of and you know, learned from, like, all of that is blues oriented, blues related. And so I feel like that kind of carries through. That's a thread that carries through all of my music. You know, even as far out as we like to go, it's like that kind of raw expression is still right there in the forefront.
Yes, I would say, yeah, when you hear you hear the blues. Now, of course, you grew up in Kansas City. I'm a fellow Missourian, as I told you earlier, a city with an amazing music heritage all its own. Tell us about your early years and how you got started in the music business.
Well, when I started playing guitar, I was like 15, 16 years old. And,
you know, I started kind of slowly learning how to play and sing at the same time. My parents listened to a lot of rock and roll. Really what I had, you know, I say I had the internet, but really it was like, I did have a lot, you know, most of my music came from like driving around in the car, listening to the radio. And so guitar solos, you could hear them on country radio or classic rock. So I kind of gravitated towards classic rock and realizing that, you know, Keith Richards' heroes were all blues guitar players. And, you know, Mike Campbell, it's the same, like all my heroes, I'm like going backwards and finding the roots of, you know, where this music came from. But Kansas City, you know, that kind of added another interesting dynamic when I wanted to go out and start cutting my teeth and sitting in with people and playing in bands. You know, Kansas City has had such a, I mean, there's a massive tradition there of jazz and blues. I mean, if you, you know, look up Kansas City and the history of music, it's pretty rich. And you know, at that time coming up there, there was something to do every night of the week. I could go to a jam or a sit-in and cut my teeth, but I really needed to learn songs kind of within the tradition. So that's what I did. You know, I think that really helped to color what I was doing.
Amazing story about you. You used to get a phone book and you would call clubs to see if you could get gigs in your early days.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was trying to make money. And so I would just, you know, I got to a point where I knew the clubs that were really good to play. Like I could see, you know, all right, if you want to be a touring musician, you're going to be coming through here. But, you know, I had to kind of work up from the very, very bottom. I couldn't just walk into the touring club, you know, they wouldn't hire me. So I had to start really at the bottom and just try to fill in, you know, I wanted a band and I wanted to keep the band. So I had to pay the band. And the only way to pay the band was to have them playing a lot. So yeah, I would call up just random places and be like, hey, you want to give me some money? And I'll bring a PA system and set up on Friday. And, you know, 99% of the time they'd be like, you know, no, hell no. What are you talking about? But, you know, it started working though. You know, I got a couple steady weekly gigs, you know, I started having that. And then all I had to fill in was like weekends. And then, you know, word started getting out. We started kind of developing a little crowd and following. And then, you know, the bigger clubs started kind of letting us in because we're, you know, proving ourselves. And that it just kind of, you know, started working from the ground up. You know, you just had to go out there and make it happen.
I think that's good advice for any aspiring musician. You know, you just got to have the guts to go out there and do it. And I think just calling up folks is good enough.
And honestly, I cringed at the thought that that's what I did. I honestly, I don't think I would have the balls to do it, but I was so young and dumb. I was just like, yeah, I'll call him and ask him for a gig. You know, at the time it was just, I felt very passionate. Like I can do this. I can fill this in. I can make this happen. And, you know, but once we had the opportunity to go out there and show them, like, we can bring people, we can develop a following and we can put on a good show. You know, it makes all that stuff, you know, for me, it made it worth it.
Absolutely. I think yeah. It's an amazing start. You know, one thing I've always liked about your music is you play the cigar box guitar, and that goes back to some of the earliest years of blues, of course, when a lot of musicians couldn't afford a factory made guitar, they made their own. And I'm curious to know how you got drawn to the cigar box guitar.
I remember the exact moment, actually. This is like one of those weird stories where I actually do remember. My dad took me and my sister to the King Biscuit Blues Festival in Helena, Arkansas when I was like 17 years old. It was my first ever festival concert kind of experience. And I went down there and they had a main stage and they had, you know, really great national acts playing on it. But on this midway, they had a lot of like street musicians playing. And I kept seeing these cigar box guitars and the way they were being utilized was kind of as, you know, like I saw like a guy named Richard Johnston, he was utilizing his as a bass and a guitar. Like his low strings were connected to, you know, bass pickups while his high strings were connected, you know, with more guitar oriented. And he had him going to different amps. And so he was creating this really fat sound out of like just one little instrument. I don't know. I thought it was really cool and guttural. And I never heard tones like that. And it stuck with me. I thought it was unique. So fast forward years later, I got brought in to play that festival as one of the, you know, nationally touring circuit acts. And I was walking down that same midway and I saw a guy selling them on the street corner. So I just kind of bought it as like, you know, like a little full circle, you know, this is just a little gift I bought myself, whatever. You didn't think much of it. I plugged it in at a show and just people kind of lit up, you know, and it's been sort of, you know, Like I have to play it now. People yell for it. If I don't pull it out at a show, people get upset.
Yeah, it's so true.
I guess it's my thing now.
A sound all its own, and they're beautiful. They really are in many ways works of art. Do you buy yours from a specific maker?
Well, I still have that same one that I bought on the Midway all those years ago. Like he sent me another one and it was probably even nicer than the one that I bought, but it just did not quite sound the same. Like I was like, it's good. It's nice, but mine has such a unique personality that, you know, and I've been given some really incredible cigar box over the years. Cause I didn't realize there was such a wide community out there. I mean, when we started doing the Cigar Box Festival, I partnered with the New Orleans Cigar Box Festival to do ours before COVID happened. I didn't realize like the community of builders that was out there. I mean, it's almost, there's more people that are building than even almost playing them, you know, just, and they're really like tight knit, and it's cool to see how creative people are. So, I mean, I've gotten some really beautiful creative gifts over the years, but I'm really just, I love mine. Like the other day I was playing it and I was playing it a little too hard and I broke it. Like I completely, the guitar strap, I thought the strap fell off, but actually half of the guitar just like snapped off the back. So I taped it up and it works just fine now. And that guitar is running on its last legs. I don't know what I'm going to do when it breaks, because I just like it so much.
Well, I can see why you'd be very attached to it. It sounds like it's got some mojo kind of built into it. You're a songwriter, you know, as well as a singer and guitarist. And I'm always curious about those who find inspiration to put music down on paper. What is your process when you're writing a song? And is it something that kind of is a lightning strike or something that comes over a long period of time? How does that work for you?
There are multiple ways up that mountain, honestly. I wish I had one process that I could detail for you, because it would be nice if I could just have one process, because as a songwriter, we'd all wish that, because it'd make it a life a lot easier. But, you know, sometimes, you know, for me, driving helps, because it's like your mind kind of clears enough, like you're focusing on something in front of you, but then, you know, your mind starts turning out stuff. So I'll get little melodies sometimes when I'm driving, and I try to jot them down, you know, or record them, because to me, that's always been something that helps me clear the channels enough to get something usable. But I don't know. I mean, every once in a while I'll get a melody. I start with that, a good starting point. You don't know if that's a vocal melody, a hook, a bass line. It could be anything, but it's a start. Sometimes I'll have pages and pages of, you know, what some people would consider poetry or words, you know, a story that I want to tell, but I don't have any music to go with it. And sometimes I'll sit down with a guitar and just kind of jam out till I can find something that might be cool to work with. But I don't know. I think a lot of my most successful ideas come from that melody thing, you know, because to me, that's like, you want to look for hooks first, because they're the hardest thing to find. If you can find a good hook, you can build a song around it. I wish it all fell together like lightning sometimes. That's happened a couple times for me where I just sat down and the whole thing just sort of, but there it is right here. But a lot of it, you know, it's a labor of love. It's a discipline. You gotta get after it. You gotta chase down the idea and make it work.
And your most recent album was titled Faster. It's out by Rounder. It was in 2021. I know I read a quote where you said, I really thought after 2020, I'd end up at the really dismal, bleak album. But instead we came up with something that's fun and sexy and empowering. So tell us about Faster. What was all the creative energy behind that?
Well, I met this producer named Martin Kirzenbaum, actually another Kansas City connection. I never thought moving to New Orleans, I'd meet so many people from Kansas City. But I didn't meet him in New Orleans. He reached out during the pandemic and just said, hey, I just want to let you know, I love what you're doing. And I think you're onto something. And if you ever need anything, hit me up. And, you know, Martin is, if you look him up on Wikipedia, he's got, quite a list of accomplishments. You know, he worked with like Lady Gaga, and he's worked with Madonna, and he's done some massive records. He manages Sting and Shaggy, and like he's heavy in the pop world, and his production sense kind of it really mirrors that. So when it came time to look for a producer, like he just kept popping up in my head. I was like, you know, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, he and I connected with each other, and we were kind of at this point friends and familiar and speaking on the phone. And so when Martin came into the process, he brought
you've really brought like a lot of enthusiasm and energy, and kind of gave me like this sense of, you know, purpose during a time where I felt, you know, kind of useless. Like we didn't have anything to do for so long. It's hard to be, you know, I know a lot of musicians felt lost and, you know, not sure, you know, of our life choices, what we were doing. And Martin coming into the fold and bringing that, you know, enthusiasm and creative energy, it's like, it kind of sparked something in me. And I wanted to work on something and make something that coming out of this would make people feel good, make them feel confident. And, you know, I wanted to do something danceable. I wanted to do something fun. It'd been such a, you know, not fun time period. And I wanted to come out of it swinging and like, you know, like we could, like we didn't miss a beat, you know?
Well, I certainly think you accomplished that. I've listened to it. It's fantastic.
Thanks.
Now, you are touring, of course, all the time. I read that you do up to 200 shows yearly, and that's on a global tour scale as well. How do you keep your stamina up? How does that work?
Like I was telling before we started the conversation, like we started this call, like this week has been particularly insane. Like across the country 6 times in the last probably 9 days, 10 days. Sleep, if you can get it, is absolutely the most important thing for me as a vocalist. Like, you know, your voice requires rest and sleep, water, just trying not to burn the candle we're always burning the candle at both ends, but you just got to do it strategically. You know, my whole day revolves around this 2.5 hours that I'm going to be on stage. You know, whatever curveball your travel or your logistical problems throw at you, you know, as long as you keep that 2.5 hours sacred, like this is the part of the day that I am preparing for. It's what people are coming for. You know, they've waited a long time. They've got tickets. They, you know, they're here to have a good time. And that's what I'm here to provide for them. I don't know, just having that kind of North Star, like this is my priority. I can shape the rest of my day around it. Like if I have to go take a nap, you know, I'll make that happen. If I have to take myself out of a sound check situation, go, cause I have to prioritize, you know, getting ready or resting, you know, you just do what you have to do to make the show happen. It's not a perfect system, of course, you know, I mean, there's some days that are exhausting but you just have to make it work and you have to want to do it. I think wanting to do it is half the battle, really.
Indeed. Well, that rush from the audience must really account for a lot. I mean, your shows are very energetic. And how does it feel to be up there on stage and seeing all these people really in sync?
They give me the energy. You know, when I walk out and if I'm feeling less than or tired, you know, they fix that for me because they've come prepared to have a good time. And I just, you know, it sort of like centers me and grounds me. Like I'm here to provide this for, you know, people that came to see me, and I'm honored, you know, it's an honor to get to perform to people that like your songs, you know, stuff that you wrote and came up with. I mean, it's overwhelming. It's an honor. You know, I'm privileged to get to do this, you know, not only for a living, just in general, I'm lucky. And, you know, that gives me energy that helps me with stamina. You know, it's funny. Sometimes you walk off stage and you just want to kind of curl up in a ball and collapse. But like while you're up there, it's electric.
I'm sure. We're going to take a brief break and I will be back after this station identification to discuss more with Samantha Fish here on Beat Cafe 102.3 WHIV FM.
All New Orleans, all the time, 24/7 WHIV 102.3 FM New Orleans.
And I'm back for Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson. I am here with the blues singer and guitarist Samantha Fish. And we've been discussing her career. Samantha, you're based in New Orleans. I'm curious to know how New Orleans came to be your home. Like we said earlier, you're originally from Kansas City, but what drew you down to New Orleans?
Well, I mean, I love Kansas City. It's my home. That's my, you know, my real, real, real home. But I also, I don't know, a few years ago, I just kind of hit this point where I was like, I really want to go just try something somewhere else. I want to, you know, spread my wings, right? And I kind of ran the gamut of places like, okay, I could, you know, where do musicians go live? Obviously Nashville is brought up and like, you know, you think of the obvious, like New York, LA, this and that, but I'd been to New Orleans several times and it had kind of like, I don't know, as a kid, I came here and it just sort of spoke to me. Like I just fell in love with the city. I'm, And I'm into folklore too. You know, all my heroes came to New Orleans. And if you read like the old rock and roll books, you know, Zeppelin was down here, the Stones down here. I mean, I a lot of my, you know, like Bob Dylan wrote songs about New Orleans. So to me, there's like, there's a romance and there's a poetry and inspiration. And I wanted to come here and be a part of that and soak that up and just enjoy it. And New Orleans has been lovely. You know, I mean, my, I built a band out of here back in like 2017. So that was, you know, that was part of the reason for the move. Like, I was like, well, this will make sense logistically. And also I get to go somewhere that I've kind of had this love affair with for a long time, but New Orleans has been really, really lovely to me. Like, I feel, you know, I'm a bit reclusive, but it's like they've embraced me. You know, we've gotten to perform at Jazz Fest, and the city is really just, I don't know, just embraced me in a way that I wasn't fully expecting. So
it is a city that endlessly inspires. It's, yeah. It's a city of constant stimulation. Is I'm just both good and bad.
But you got to be careful. Like, yeah. I learned that. I was like, wow, we can have, you know, booze in the morning here. That's cool. And I was like, after a while, I'm like, oh, I gotta calm that down.
it takes a sense of moderation to go the full distance in New Orleans.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to check myself a couple times, but I think I've got the hang of it now. I found a balance.
Very good. Now I know you have a album collaboration that's coming up with country musician, Jesse Dayton. I'm curious to know how this partnership came to be.
Look, I've been knowing Jesse since I was a teenager, really. I mean, when I used to go to there's this place in Kansas City called Knuckleheads, which was the big touring circuit club I was alluding to earlier. And Jesse used to come in there. I mean, he still does. He'd play and he'd draw these massive crowds. And I just, you know, always had an admiration for him. We did some shows together back then and just, I don't know, kind of loosely kept in touch, but we hadn't seen each other for a number of years. He came through New Orleans earlier last year, and me and my manager went out to check him out because I hadn't seen him in a minute. And, you know, he just has always blown me away. So I'd been tossing this idea around for a long time about wanting to find somebody to do a collaborative project with, and just seeing him, you know, I remember leaning over to my manager and going like, hey, this is that thing I was talking about. We've been talking about for so long. This is the guy, and this is what we should, I want to do this, you know? And he was into it. And, you know, it was just cool because we hadn't seen each other in a while, and finding each other again, and we're thick as thieves, really, like, because we get along great. And it was like no time at all had passed since we'd seen each other. So we just started writing. We started writing to see what we could come up with. And I think it's like a really, I think it's going to be a really beautiful record, honestly, just something that different for both of us. It's beautifully balanced. And it's a story record. It's about relationships. It's a cool project for me. It's beautiful.
And have you done a lot of country music in the past? I mean, is this something new for you, or is this part?
Well,
of
it's actually not country music. we both kind of stepped out ourselves. John Spencer produced it. So we really wanted to come out and do something like aggressive and raw and bluesy, but also, you know, have these, I don't know, different elements that John could bring in. So we both are kind of stepping away from the thing that people sort of know us for, and it's going to be something different. So it's not too country, but I mean, of course, whenever you bring somebody like Jesse Dayton in, he is essentially, like, quintessentially outlaw country. So he brings that flavor in, I bring my flavor in, and it's just something unique for both of us. But as far as me doing country music, I'd say the closest I ever came was probably the Belle of the West record, and it was more like alternative Americana. But I've dabbled in a lot of different things, you know. I like to dip my toe into different genres and try new things. So I'm not afraid of it at all.
Now, I also read that at one point you were, I guess, at a concert of Buddy Guy, and you were called up on stage. What was that experience like? a true legend, of course, a Louisianan as well.
I don't know. I was so scared I blacked out. So I was so nervous, honestly. We that day, that was another hellacious travel day. I remember it. We played Kansas City, and then we had to go play Thunder Bay, Ontario on a Saturday, which is way, way, way up there. And Greg Guy, who's Buddy's son that I'd known from Buddy Guy's club playing there over the years, called me and he said, hey, you know, if you can make it back here on Sunday night, I could probably get you up on stage with Buddy. And so, you know what we did?
we drove through the night after this festival, all the way from Thunder Bay, Ontario, back to Kansas City to get on stage. So when he called me up, I didn't think it was going to happen. It was like, it was just kind of maybe a chance. And he did. And I don't know. I was so nervous and kind of blown away, but we did get to trade licks. And that was like a big, you know, that was a big story for a long time. But then we finally did some dates together, you know, fast forward years later. I say the better jam story was we were together at the, there's a place called the Wolf Trap. Yeah. Out in Alexandria, Virginia. And we'd done like 5 dates together. And I didn't want to bother him, you know, I mean, I'm sure everybody comes and like wants to take his time. So I hadn't been bugging him while we were on tour with them. And his guitar player came up to me and said, "Hey, buddy wants to know why you haven't come said hello to him yet." I didn't think he'd remember me, you know. I was like, "Well, I didn't want to bother him." He's like, "Well, he's getting kind of offended that you won't even come say hi." So I said, "All right." So I came in there and we sat and we talked for like 30 minutes just about being on the road and traveling. And he's a lovely guy. And he got me up on stage with him that night. And I'll tell you, I was more confident. And I remember actually like trading licks with him back and forth. And we had this really cool musical conversation. Like Buddy to me is the best at speaking with his instrument. He has a voice. It's a real voice. Like, and he talks with it and he connects with people. And so like learning how to have a conversation with him on guitars, it's like a master's class. And he's amazing, you know, how emotive he is with his guitar playing.
What a moment. Wow.
That was really cool.
An incredible story. We're going to close out the interview by listening to one of your songs. It's Bulletproof, and you do play the cigar box guitar on this song. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, we talked about, you know, the cigar box so much. I think this is probably one of my most popular songs. I wanted to do something that felt like North Mississippi meets, you know, an electronic dance, like an industrial dance beat. So, yeah, you know, use your imagination. You'll hear the song. You'll get it.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Samantha. We look forward to seeing you again at the Bluesberry Festival in Covington on October 8th. And of course, you'll be appearing nationwide and hopefully back here in New Orleans in good time.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you again for your time, and I'll see y'all soon.
And here we go with Bulletproof.
WHIV 102.3 FM. What's the difference in me now?
Hello and welcome to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat, and I am thrilled today to be joined by a father and son, the son being Orlando Gilbert and the father, John Prince Gilbert. They have teamed up to record a new single. It's called New Orleans Party. It will be out October 7th. The album, or the song, I should say, the song includes Herlin Riley, Chris Severin, Terrence Taplin, and Karen Shariishi. So welcome, guys. Happy to have you here today.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks for having us.
So, Orlando, let's start with you here with the sun. Tell me how this song came to be. Who wrote it, and how did you and your father come together to make it happen?
Well, it was really cool because, like, I wrote the melody and stuff while I was still in Boston. I recently just graduated from college, and I was spending some time there after I graduated because the pandemic was just crazy. So I'm writing the song for the album, and I don't really have that many lyrics for it or anything. I'm not too great with lyrics. So I just brought it in, and I was like, I don't know, this feels like a New Orleans party. What can you do with this, Dad? And he just came up with the lyrics on the spot in the studio. And it was wonderful. I mean, like, you know, he absolutely killed it. And he's the lead vocalist on this song as well. And he's also the lead vocalist on many of the other tunes on this album, which is great because everyone knows my father is a saxophonist. He's also known for being a vocalist, but this will be the first time that we have it recording with him singing.
Of course, New Orleans is always a party.
Yeah.
So tell me, John, how did these lyrics come to you? I'm going to make sure I have this clear. You already had the tune,
yeah,
correct? And then he just added the lyrics.
Yeah.
So tell me, John, how did you come up with the lyrics for this song?
Well, basically, when he brought the song to me and let me hear it, he was telling me he wanted something like a New Orleans party. So I just, on the spot, I just sung what I felt. Hey, there it is.
You know, it kind of reminds me of when Uncle Lionel used to say, party over here, party over there, party everywhere.
Yeah.
Right.
So, John, you've had quite a long history here in the brass band scene. Why don't you tell me how it got started for you?
Basically, I started playing music when I was a child. I was always fascinated by playing. I was always the type of child that wanted to be the best of the best. One day I just happened to be sitting in a playground playing on my instrument. Lucian already knew who I was, Lucian
Barber.
Lucian said, man, why don't you come with us? I said, okay, let's go. And so I wound up over by Mr. Danny Barber's house. And it was practicing, Craig Staff and all of them, Leroy Chum. They're playing the song, and I'm just listening. So Barber said, you want to join in? I said, yes. So I played the song, and it was like, what's your name? I told him my name. Yeah. Ever since then, I've been into the brass band scene. Played with the Olympia Brass Band. I played with the 30 Dozen. I'm an original member of the Rebirth. And I played with a variety of people. Brass band, R&B bands, like Lauryn Hill, yeah, things like that.
Right.
Yeah, so.
That's quite an illustrious string of bands, obviously.
Of
so you were playing your saxophone in the park, you said, at the time?
Yeah, I was sitting in the playground, in Lehman Playground, practicing.
Wow.
I wasn't expecting nobody to come
to pay any attention, right?
Right.
And that was with Danny Barker's brass band then, or the Fairview Baptist Church brass band is what you were part of. Right,
yeah,
right.
The young guy.
Right, right.
He liked it, all of us, too.
Well, Danny was certainly a mentor to so many.
Yeah, he was a loving man.
Yeah.
He couldn't ask for a better person.
True. So, Orlando, you obviously grew up with a father who was making a lot of music. Did it immediately influence you? Did you go, that's exactly what I want to do? Or how did it come around to you?
Well, for me, you know, I was around it all the time. And, you know, my mom's, she moved here from Chicago, and she fell in love with the culture and fell in love with my father. So, you know, when I was a baby and like a young child, there was a lot of going to second lines, a lot of exposure in that regard. But I didn't really want to do music at first. That was kind of pushed on me by my mom. My dad was less pushy. He just wanted me to do what I wanted to do. But my mom, you know, she got me a clarinet. She got me a saxophone. I wasn't really liking it. But then I got to Ben Franklin High School, and I noticed that like some of my friends were leaving for half the day to go play music. And I was like, that sounds pretty fun. So in my 10th grade year, I had some familiarity with the horn already, but I picked it up and I started practicing for about a year. And my ninth grade year. And then my 10th grade year, I attended NOCA. The rest was history. I fell in love from there.
So now, when did you start composing music? And that's quite a challenge. It's one thing to kind of play along, but to come up with an original score, that's challenging.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think when I first started music, like, you know, seriously, I always had an interest in composition. It didn't necessarily come natural to me. I wrote a lot of bad songs, but I kept at it, and I attended Berklee College of Music, and they you know, had a lot of classes that emphasized, you know, coming in with compositions as part of my grade. So when you have deadlines, you meet them, and it was great practice, and it prepared me for the project that I'm working on now, for sure.
So I'm curious, when you go to a school, you know, Berklee obviously has a great, amazing reputation. Are they really open to kind of this New Orleans sound? Is that something they're familiar with up there?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, well, when I went to Berklee, like I mentioned that my father had, you know, started the Rebirth Brass Band, and many, many teachers were aware of that already, which was nice to kind of have that credibility kind of going in, you know. And then I met mentors like Ralph Peterson and Bill Pierce. Both of them played like in our Blakey's band with Terrence and Donald and Winton and Branford during the Young Lions generation. And they were already kind of aware that New Orleans had a thing going on, you know, and I knew their friends, so I kind of had it in. So it was a really cool thing. Like, there was a big respect for the
New Orleans. Respect for New Orleans. That's good to hear, because that's not always the case.
Yeah.
So, John, obviously, like your son mentioned, you're a founding member of the Rebirth Brass Band, a band that really revolutionized so much of the sound here. Tell me what those days were like when you guys were all coming together.
We would get together every day. There's no doubt that we were brothers. Eat, sleep, and play together all day. We got to know one another. We got to know what he's going to do at this time and what he's going to do before. It was like that, you know. So it combined in itself, formed it.
Friends and musicians, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
We were
the best of friends.
And when did you all start touring? I mean, I know you made a name for yourselves here in New Orleans, obviously, first.
We started touring in 1983. Okay. 83.
Right, so early.
That was after the first album, Interstate.
You know, you guys were adding, you know, a much more kind of powerful punch to this old tradition. What do you think kind of was the energy behind that? What led you guys to kind of take this and experiment with it?
We was basically made and influenced by the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
So we tried to follow Lady to take our way of doing it. Our music and put it into a different twist to what they were doing. We come up with our own recipe.
And how did you come up with the name Rebirth?
Oh, man, that's a good one. At first, the name of the band used to be The Group.
Okay. And it's that simple.
Oh, wow. We were up there at the Kingsley House uptown. And the guys say, man, y'all to be Rebirth. Yeah, y'all gonna be Rebirth. Day. And ever since that day, that we was Rebirth.
Just magically kind of appeared on someone's mouth.
It's come out of somebody's mouth. Just like the song, Do What You Want.
A true anthem here.
It came straight out of dude's mouth. Tyrone Miller used to always tell us, do what you want. Do what you want. I said, okay, we got you. And this one day, it was me, Wolf, and Philip, and Kermit. We were in the backyard, and we figured out, do what you want out right now.
I love that song because, you know, to me, it isn't Mardi Gras until you hear do what you wanna. Mm-hmm. And isn't that the whole point of the day? Right. You do what you want.
You know, it's funny. Like, I think that song's really the catalyst for this album. Because after I graduated in 2020, so it was like pandemic time, super weird. I found myself in London for about 2 months teaching at this place called World Heartbeat Music Academy under this woman who runs it, Sarhana Garo. And she showed me, she asked me to, you know, teach a New Orleans music class. And I was like, of course, I'll do that. And the students had already been working some stuff out before I got there. And she showed me a video of them playing Do What You Want. And I was like, well, now this is funny because my father, you know, instrumental in helping write that tune. And I was like, well, do you know who wrote this? And they were like, well, Rebirth, right? And I was like, nah, my father. So, and, you know, I, on my way back from London, I was thinking about it and I was like, man, my father's influence has spread across the world. And I thought it was really unfortunate that even though people felt his music, they didn't know his name. So I set out to do this album, you know, with him in order to kind of state for the record that, like, you know, John Gilbert is responsible for a lot of the big changes that happened in New Orleans music.
Absolutely. Yes. We are in the midst of a legend, truly. So you said this is an album. This is your first single that's coming out of this album.
Yes.
Are they all original songs?
The majority of them. I think we have three standards and then one tuned by our piano player, Karen. But the rest is originals. So yeah.
That's great. And they all were composed by you?
Yes.
Wow. Was this something you were working on in school, or has this just been something that's been in your mind since you left?
Well, you know, my mom's been in my ear about doing an album with my dad for a long time. So
we should mention your mom, Anne Marie Caviello.
Yes.
She is a teacher here in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Obviously didn't leave when she left the classroom, she was still home teaching.
right, yeah. For sure.
And so you said you eventually had some reluctance to take up music. What was kind of the spark that then launched you?
Well, I think the thing that did it for me was, well, first I was like, well, it seems like fun. Like, you know, I get to, you know, play music for half the day and not do school. And, you know, I thought that was kind of an attractive deal. But when I got to Tinoco, being at their new facility, and they have this like big bay window that overlooks the Mississippi. And like, it was just this like beautiful, beautiful day. There was like a clear sky, but like a little bit of mist on the Mississippi River. And like, I'm learning music with Michael Pallera, Kari Allen Lee, Michael Reiner, Chris Severin, who's also on the album. And I was just like, wow, this is for me.
As I say, it's not your average classroom.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that facility is incredible. And the list of alumni just continues to get more and more impressive. And you are joining their ranks. And we're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause here at Beat Cafe on WHIV 102.3. I'll be back to talk more with Orlando Gilbert and his father, John Prince Gilbert.
We've got you covered, New Orleans, WHIV-FM, and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org, WHIVLP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
And welcome back to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson. I am joined today by Orlando Gilbert and his father, John Prince Gilbert. They have a new single out that's coming on a larger album. The song is titled New Orleans Party. It debuts October 7th. We'll get a chance to hear it at the end of the show. During the break, we were having an interesting conversation. Orlando mentioned, of course, that he benefited so greatly from attending NOCA, the New Orleans Center for Creative Arts here in New Orleans. And we have just found out that his father also attended in its very earliest years. So, John, tell me about your introduction to NOCA when you were a high school student.
I was in high school. I was playing clarinet at the time.
Okay.
And the Stamps with the band that were at that club. And she recommended that I have a chance to go there. So my 12th grade year, I attended NOCA, but it was like a half a day. I thought it was cool too. But in the long run, it paid off for me because the staff had helped me, interviews or whatever you want to say, auditions, 14 different universities. And I was awarded 14 different scholarships.
Wow.
And Berkeley was one of the scholarships. And I was excited, and I kept begging my mom. And she treated me like a baby. She didn't want me to leave. She didn't want me. That's too far from home. I said, come on, mom, it's an opportunity for a lifetime. No, you can't go. So I just sucked it up with the grandma.
We got another great school.
Yeah,
I went to up in North Louisiana. Were you in the marching band?
Oh, yes, I was.
Now that is impressive.
I was in the university band. One of the first bands to go to Tokyo, and I was the first band to do a Coca-Cola commercial.
Wow. That's fascinating.
You see me up front, right? The drum major right there doing this thing. I'm right on the side dancing. Oh, yeah.
We got to find that Coca-Cola ad.
Yeah, you can find it.
You know what year approximately that was?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I can't remember.
So what was it like being in the Grambling Band? I mean, they have had a reputation for a long time.
It was lovely, man. Under the direction of Dr. Wally, Dr. Hutchison, Dr. Miller, were some of the greatest teachers. Mr. Wally, he was my personal teacher, like my major instrument teacher. He was crazy about me.
As he should have been.
When I went to Grambling, this was the kick spot. I'm coming down the hall. I'm already late getting there. Everybody already been there. Here I come down the hall. I don't see nobody in the building. I'm playing the clarinet. I'm blowing that pee fountain out the ground. And I turned the corner and went into these double doors and pushed it open. Everybody, they go, the whole band sitting in the band room. I'm like, ooh. And everybody's turning, they looking. And Dr. Wallace said, come here. I came in, everybody looking at me. And they asked me my name. I told him my name. And he said, come have a seat right here. I've been waiting for you. Because I auditioned for him.
Right.
Because I went to Grandma and did the audition. He shot a scholarship to my house less than 4 days.
That's 4 days. Obviously, he wanted you.
Yeah. It all worked it out.
Indeed. Then you come back and start the Rebirth Brass Band, and the rest is history.
Yep. There you go. Oops. There it is.
Now, you've both played in second line parades, and I'm always curious to know about that experience. It takes so much energy.
Yeah, it did, because it took a lot of my energy playing the second line, toting him on my back.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You're playing the instrument and carrying
him?
Yep.
Wow. I hope not recently.
No. We about 23 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Shoot.
Wow, that is so special. Do you have any really early memories of being in the second line for it?
Not really, but I think my left ear hears a little bit less well than the right ear. And I think that might have been from being in my face.
Right there. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, the back line, I mean, the drums were and the tuba were right there.
The tuba right behind.
You literally slammed right between them all.
But I was crazy about the tuba as a kid as a result, I think. You know.
Do you remember the first time you performed in the second line?
Oh man, actually, that's what the album cover's picture is based off.
Yes, it's both of you with your saxophones.
It's really fortunate that someone caught that moment. But Dad was playing with the Hot 8 at the time, right. And I was 13, and you know, my mom was kind of, you know, kicking me in the backside, being like, "Hey, you need to go play with your dad," you know. And so that was the first time me and my father ever played together, and it was a second line. And I think actually it was the. It was one of the ones that just passed recently. Starts with a G.
The Young Men Olympians?
No. Olympians or no. So good. Many.
Oh, man, I can't remember.
That's all right.
There's so many of them.
Yeah.
I played practically all of them.
Yeah, I know.
I'm sure you have at this point in time.
Cool.
Yeah.
What does it take, really? I mean, do you really feel kind of pumped up at the start? I mean, how do you maintain that energy going the whole way through?
It's like when you get there, you know it's on. You got to do what you got to do.
Right.
Wow, that's what done. You
know, yeah.
Do what you have to do, and then go speak for itself.
Sometimes it doesn't feel like work, though. I mean, like, you know, when you have, like, someone like, I don't know, Derek Tabb on, like, you know, on the snare drum.
Oh, yeah, but you know, the only thing was the killer was the heat. The heat.
Yeah, the that heat. Is a killer.
The heat. Oh, the heat will get you. The heat will really take you out. That's true.
Quick. I used to say about the dude with the ice chef. Dip my cup in there, get that cold water, pour it all over my body. Lord, it'll be the heat.
That's the way. That's the way. You got to do what you got to do.
In my lifetime, I think I did over 10,000 funerals.
Wow. That is a lot, too. Of
course, I think I did.
That's a lot more than 10,000 hours.
Is there any particular musician whose funeral you played in that immediately comes to mind?
What played with?
Yeah, one that really kind of has left a lasting impression on you.
Uncle Lionel.
Yes.
Uncle Lionel did. That was one of the kicks his nicest person he ever wanted to meet.
There's really never going to be another Uncle Lionel.
Oh, no.
He was one of a kind.
That's it.
Yes. And a friend to everybody.
And I was close to a lot of musicians. Harold Dejean, Bill Baptiste, Doc Watson, Lucian Borgrand, Ralph Johnson, a lot of boom cats. I was...
You really bridges those generations. You
know? Yeah, I got a chance to play with the older guys that was older than me and my dad. And that's how I learned, by listening and watching. One of my teachers, Freddie Kemp and Kid Jordan, Elliot Kaye, as we call him, Stack Man, he's always say when he see me, turn y'all back, hide your fingers. And he come. He said, then again, don't worry about it. His ears too big. He's going to hear everything you play anyway.
Do you feel like you're now in a role where you're mentoring the younger generation, obviously your son?
Of course. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of this guy.
As you should be.
Of course. Apple don't fall too far from the tree.
Indeed. Did you ever envision your son taking it this far?
I always say if he got interested in it, he would go for it. I always do it. You know?
Well, we look forward to hearing this song. We're going to get a sneak preview on this show here at the very end. And I want to thank both of you guys for joining me today. It's been a lesson in New Orleans jazz history and the future of our sound as well.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you both. And here we go with New Orleans Party.
Go by terms on a Sunday, that's the spot. I wanna have